This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 186, Flashback, 1 year later. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. This is episode 186. It's our Flashback, 1 year later episode. This is actually the fifth Flashback episode we'll be doing. I'm your host, Adam Chapman, by the way. I didn't even introduce myself. How rude is that? I shall also offer you a cold beverage. But anyway, Flashback. This is our fifth episode of the Flashback brand. So the last five episodes, we've kind of looked at a particular comic or something in the past. I've talked about kind of what I was doing at that time, how I kind of came across those issues, what I liked about them. The first time we did a flashback, we went to Spider-Man, Spider-Hunt, and Identity Crisis back in 98. For the second time we did a flashback, which was episode 132, in January, we went to 1996, 1997 to look at Heroes Reborn. For episode 140, at the end of January, we did a flashback to Spider-Man Hobgoblin Lives. And then our last one, so apparently, of the first four flashbacks, three of the four were Spider-Man related. Episode 144 in February was the last flashback episode, so that was over 40 episodes ago. Holy crap, that's a lot of time. That was our flashback to Spider-Man Maximum Carnage. So that was in 1990, I believe, 92 or 3. So today we're going to do something a little bit different, in that after four episodes looking at Marvel, of which three of the four were Spider-Man related, we're instead going to look at something from the other side of the aisle, DC related. In fact, we're taking a look at 1 year later. Part of what made me think about maybe doing something about that like this is the upcoming Time Runs Out Marvel kind of Avengers storyline in Avengers and New Avengers by Jonathan Hickman. It's going to be flashing to 8 months into kind of the future of the Marvel Universe, and then we're gonna kind of see a different looking Marvel Universe, and then over the next 8 months we'll bridge the gap and see how those things happened. So I thought I would go back to 2006 and look at 1 year later, which was a bit of a marketing branding that was done in the wake of Infinite Crisis. So to set the stage, in 2005 we had Infinite Crisis going on. In fact, it was running all through 2005. We had the countdown to Infinite Crisis. The prelude, I think, came out in March of that year. Then you had the four countdown to Infinite Crisis miniseries, of which one of them was the Rand Thanagar War, one of them was Villains United, one of them was, I think it was Day of Vengeance, I always screw that up, it might be Day of Judgment, I can't remember right now, and then the OMAC Project was the other one. Those all led up to Infinite Crisis. Infinite Crisis was this big kind of, I guess it was basically like 20 years since the original Crisis, roughly, so it was this big, exciting storyline. It's interesting, actually, that it's almost been, not 10 years, but I mean, it's next year is going to be 10 years since Infinite Crisis. Like, that is hard for me to even believe, because it doesn't seem like it's been that long, because it was running in 2005 and 2006. It's just crazy to me how fast time moves, and how, in a lot of ways, it doesn't seem like it's been that long. Like, I think of Avengers Disassembled as having not happened that long ago, when really it happened in, like, I don't know, the kind of late summer, early fall of 2004. So that's, you know, just about a decade old. It's crazy. I mean, it's just those types of things. I mean, when I read that, I mean, I was, I think, in second year university. I had just started kind of writing comic reviews for this website, comicstream.com, which later became known as CX Pulp. So I was really excited about doing that. And I remember in 2004, I got to go to the Fan Expo here in Toronto, Ontario. I think it was the first time I ever went with a press pass, which was really exciting to me at the time. I got to do audio interviews, obviously, with Brian Azzarello, who at the time was writing Superman for Tomorrow. I also got to talk to, I think, Rags Morales about Identity Crisis, which had just started. And I also got to talk to, I believe, Mike Diodato Jr., well, I don't really remember anything about talking to him. I remember Rags Morales. I don't remember anything about talking to Mike Diodato Jr. But I remember the Sins Past storyline was just in the middle of happening in Spider-Man, where it looked like we were going to get, like, was it going to be Gwen Stacy and Peter's kids? We didn't know yet that it was going to be Norman's kids. Such an interesting time period. Anyways, that's actually not the time period we're talking about here. That was 2004. So 1 year later happened in 2006. happened pretty much line-wide. I'm going to talk about a few of them in particular. It all kind of started in May 2006. It was supposed to kind of be that we had the end of an infinite crisis, and then every book in the DC line would jump forward 1 year, and then originally, as it was pitched, we were supposed to get the, everything that we missed in that one-year period was supposed to be relayed to us during the 52 miniseries. Now, as it turned out, the 52 miniseries ended up not really showing us how a lot of the things that kind of we saw these big blanks, it didn't really fill in the blanks, but instead what it did is it told its own cohesive story, which, to be honest, was probably a better idea. I mean, if 52 ended up being kind of the model for a weekly series, no one thought it would work, no one thought that anyone in this day and age could do a timely weekly comic that wouldn't miss shipping dates. Everyone just thought it was crazy. I mean, looking back on it, DC's done, well, they've completely done three of them. They've done 52, Countdown, and, what was the other one? Trinity. And right now they're doing three at once, or two at once, and they're about to do a third, which is New 52, Future's End, Batman Eternal, and, I guess, Earth 2, World's End. So, I mean, at the time, the idea of a weekly just was crazy pants. And the fact that it could be this really well-put-together year-long journey, and with characters that were not the flagship characters. I mean, the fact that Black Adam was going to be one of the most interesting characters. I mean, he'd been interesting with Geoff Johns. Let's not pretend that he hadn't already been kind of a breakout character in Geoff Johns' JSA run. But seeing him as a main character here was something else completely different. Renee Montoya became the new Question, which never really, I think, got its due. We saw some storylines with her as the Question, but there was just so much build-up to her finally taking on the mantle that I felt like DC kind of dropped the ball at really promoting it and having her really become the Question and promoting the Question book. Like, the Question book can work, they just have to want to make it work, and I don't think they've really tried hard enough. Who are the other main characters of 52? Well, there's a bunch. There's Steel, there's Booster Gold. It was a phenomenal book. Anyways, 1 year later was this big publishing initiative that was really kind of made sense. It was kind of DC kind of saying, oh my god, you know, this big thing happened in an Infinite Crisis. Now we're going to jump forward a year and everything's going to be completely different. So I'm going to talk about a few of the books in particular. First up I'm going to talk about is Green Arrow. Now Green Arrow was written by Judd Winnick before and after 1 year later. It had a lot of really cool stuff happening in it that led up to where it kind of left off. Now, this is, again, one of those books where they never quite made good on the promise of showing you everything that happened or making sense of what happened in the year, the missing year, as well as what happens with the character in 52 itself. But when we leave off with Green Arrow before 1 year later, I think Star City was, like, half blown up. He was, I think, hit with an arrow. Like, it's, things looked really tragic for him. And instead, they move forward 1 year. Suddenly, Oliver Queen is the mayor of the city. Half the city's kind of walled off. It's kind of an embarrassment to the rest of the people in Star City. And I gotta say, this is probably one of the most interesting books that we got in the 1 year later era, because, I mean, the first issue, first of all, we don't even see a lot of Green Arrow himself, or even, like, Oliver Queen. We see a little bit about Green Arrow hasn't really been around, but Oliver Queen is now the mayor. That's the kind of the big revelation. What's really great about this arc is that we have Oliver Queen kind of trying to do what he's always done for his city, protect his city, but in a very different way. This attracts the ire of, eventually, Deathstroke, and leads to one of the best Deathstroke Green Arrow fights I think I've ever seen. And Scott McDaniel absolutely kills it in terms of the art. I forget the exact issue. I mean, I have the trade paperback in front of me, and of course DC doesn't give you issue numbers anywhere in their books. So I believe the issue I'm going to be referring to is, this is the trade paperback for Crawling Through the Wreckage. I believe this is issue 62 I'm talking about, with this amazing Green Arrow and Deathstroke fight where we learn, it's all actually told from Deathstroke's perspective. Deathstroke shows up, thinks he's going to have an easy time with Green Arrow, tranks him, but then soon gets quite the rude awakening, and it becomes such a thrilling, well-paced issue, one hell of an action sequence where, it turns out that Deathstroke does not have the upper hand that he thinks he does. Instead, Green Arrow not only knew he was coming, but was planning for it. And suddenly, Green Arrow is better than he's ever been. He's wearing body armor under his kind of work clothes, so he can't just be, you know, sucker punched by a trank dart. He's got adhesives ready to kind of take Deathstroke out of the offices and into a specially designed area where he can be fought by Green Arrow. Green Arrow is now brandishing a blade of his own, which is completely different. He's got all these new Eastern martial arts moves. He's actually better than he's ever been and able to take out Deathstroke. And he's able to... The whole thing is an amazing plan to stop Deathstroke in his tracks and end up having him under arrest. And this is kind of where we kind of bleed the character. Green Arrow has a bit of a weird history because after this arc, where we see more of him kind of being the mayor of Star City, it's relatively short-lived because then you have Green Arrow... in the next trade paperback that comes after Calling Through the Wreckage, dealing with a little bit of what happened in that blank year when he retrained himself on an island and went with his family. I don't think they ever adequately really discussed what really was going on with Green Arrow. We saw a little bit of it in this book, in the actual Green Arrow book by Judd Winnick, but again, it didn't really jive with the appearances of Green Arrow that we saw in the 52 book. That being said, he didn't make a lot of appearances in 52, and you can kind of just pretend he didn't show up. The whole him becoming mayor in that missing year, and also retraining himself to the extent that he did, it's asking a little bit much of the reader, but it was definitely a really strong, new direction to take for the character. That being said, at times it was the same writer, so it didn't feel that different. You still had the Arrow family, but giving Oliver Queen more of a grounding as Oliver Queen himself and making him the mayor definitely gave the book the jolt that I think it needed at the time to make it a little bit more exciting. And Scott McDaniel just absolutely killing it in art. He really brought a new, fresh, artistic perspective to the book. The next book I want to talk about that got affected by 1 year later, I mean, obviously they all did, but is Green Lantern, actually. And it's funny, at the time that this happened, I remember I was really excited that Hal Jordan was coming back in Green Lantern Rebirth, and I read that series, absolutely loved it, and then I was reading the ongoing that started by Geoff Johns, and I believe Carlos Pacheco was originally doing the art, and honestly, I couldn't stand it. I didn't like the artwork at all. I thought it was a little way too simplistic. To be honest, you got so spoiled by Ethan Van Sciver with his amazingly detailed artwork on Green Lantern Rebirth, and then you go to the extremely simple work of Carlos Pacheco on Green Lantern, and it was just so jarring that I couldn't stand it. I hated it. And then you had, I think, like a Tattooed Man story, or maybe it was a Hector Hammond story, I think, with Ethan Van Sciver. It just felt, the book felt so uneven. And then you had this two-part arc with Mongol 2 and Mongal and the Black Mercy with Green Arrow and Green Lantern. And that was right before 1 year later started, and I was kind of like, I don't know, I think I'm done with this book. I'll give it another shot. And then I read the Tattooed Man story with Green Arrow and Batman. And, you know, it was kind of a fun little story, team up. Not that consequential. It did have some really great moments, like one that's been kind of recreated in Heroclix form, where Batman puts on the Green Lantern ring and is able to kind of use it for a moment, and you have him all green with like the Green Lantern symbol kind of mixed in with the Batman symbol, and him making a picture of his parents with his kind of mind's eye, and Hal Jordan saying, you know, take control of the fear of the will and put that horrible night behind you, and Batman being able to look at the vision of his parents and saying, I don't want to. It's incredibly powerful stuff. He takes off the ring, gives it back to Hal. He actually kind of buries the hatchet finally with Hal. It was a very well-done story, but at the same time, I hadn't been enjoying the book, so that was it. I actually wiped my hands clean of Green Lantern and said, I'm done. I believe that was issue 8 of Green Lantern, and I just kind of turned my back on it and said, that's going to be it for me in Green Lantern. I gave it a shot. I gave it for more than a year, and it just did not do it for me. That was issue 9, and I was done. Then, months later, I think 6 or 7 months later, I was reading about, you know, that there's something big was about to happen. We were kind of getting inklings of what the Sinestro Corps War was going to be. The idea that there was other rings out there now. There's going to be other corps. They were going to be, you know, recruiting the Sinestro Corps in the backups. There was a storyline with what's his name? I can't remember his name. It's not a cootie, and I don't remember. It's the artist that I haven't been a big fan of on previously, but I'm enjoying right now on Daniel Acuna. There it is. He was doing an arc with Star Sapphire. I wasn't a big fan of that, but I read a little bit of what was going on in this Revenge of the Green Lanterns and Wanted Hal Jordan storyline, and I was like, you know what? Maybe I should go back. So I read the Green Lantern 1 Year Later stuff much later, because I used 1 Year Later as the perfect opportunity to jump off a book that I felt was really lagging. And I gotta say, I'm really glad that I did go back to it, because starting from issue 10, Green Lantern got a shot in the arm and came much more interesting and entertaining than it had been in the previous 9 issues. It was more consistent. Geoff Johns really found his stride. I think 1 Year Later was one of the best things to happen to Green Lantern, looking back on it. And so if we look at what was happening, Green Lantern was suddenly, you know, kind of hunted by the Rocket Reds. We never really saw a lot of what he was doing in the interim of the 1 Year Later storyline, but we saw enough of it in this book as they started to show more of how Hal Jordan was a prisoner of war during this period. He was, you know, took being a pilot a little bit too far, but this Revenge of the Green Lantern story was really strong, because, I mean, it started off with you just having, you know, not a very in-depth story of suddenly Hal Jordan being very much, you know, very dangerous. But then we have the idea of the Lost Lanterns are introduced. We see more and more of Hal Jordan being part of this reborn core and dealing with the Guardians. We see the introduction of the Manhunters working for the Manhunter Grandmaster, who's none other than Cyborg Superman. This arc was absolutely fantastic, and again, I don't know what it was about 1 Year Later, but like just like with Judd Winnick on Green Arrow, it was the same writer writing the book, but suddenly it got so much better, and that we got the same thing here for Green Lantern by Geoff Johns. Didn't hurt that Ivan Reyes became his artistic partner, and he just brought an absolutely phenomenal visual sense to this book. And I, to be honest, don't think he ever had a better artist on Green Lantern with him than Ivan Reyes. Even when he had Doug Monkey, who was no slouch on his own, Reyes really was just a phenomenal artist, and he made this Green Lantern book so much fun to look at. I mean, his interpretation of Cyborg Superman, the Ivan Reyes' ability to have so many characters on a page and never make it feel like there's too many, and never feeling like any of the characters were given like short thrift. It always felt like every character was given love and affection, if that sounds a little weird, but 1 Year Later was such a revitalization for Green Lantern, especially for me, because I had kind of given up on the character. I did not, as I said, I didn't like Carlos Pacheco in the art. I didn't really like where the story was going. I felt like the story wasn't going anywhere. And suddenly, once 1 Year Later happened, we had the long build-up to everything that would become the Sinestro Corps War. Again, like, Cyborg Superman became a huge part of that. The idea that Superboy Prime was being held captive and knew about the 52, which at the time was very tantalizing, because no one knew what the hell that meant. Because 52 was still unraveling, and we didn't know what 52 was. We didn't know that there was 52 universes. This was the book that felt most tied in some ways to what some of the secrets of the 52 miniseries was, or maxiseries was. So if you can, I mean, if you go back and read Geoff Johns' Green Lantern, which is definitely worth doing, this is where it really starts to pick up, and he starts to lay a lot of the groundwork that would become so important later on. I mean, technically speaking, he's doing a little bit of that in the first, you know, 8 or 9 issues, but not to the same extent. I mean, you get a little bit of the Hector Hammond stuff. You get a little bit of the Manhunters, the idea that there's something else out there and there's some other kind of boss of the Manhunters, which wouldn't be, you know, really capitalized on until the Revenge of the Green Lantern storyline. Yeah, but this was just so good, and just even flipping through it now, all I can think is, man, I have to sit down and actually read all this again, because it is fantastic. Next up that I wanted to talk about, we have the Superman books. So the Superman books kind of went through an interesting change. So Infinite Crisis had some great tie-ins with Superman. First of all, you had the Superman Sacrifice storyline that was part of the OMAC project slash Wonder Woman. So that's where Maxwell Lord took control of Superman. He thought he was kind of going crazy. He was becoming a danger to all those around him. Wonder Woman tried to stop him, found out that Max Lord was controlling his mind, asked Max Lord with the lasso around him, you know, how do I stop you? He said, you have to kill me, so she cracked his neck, and that was it. Shortly after that, you had the Superman Infinite Crisis tie-ins, where you had, during the fight between Superman of Earth 2 and Superman of New Earth, you had them fighting and kind of experiencing each other's lives, and they punched each other, and you had issues where it actually looked at what their alternate kind of histories would be like, which was really kind of interesting. After that, you move to 1 year later, and it's something completely different. It's written by, let's see, Kurt Busiek and Jeff Johns, artwork by Pete Woods and Renato Guedes, and this took over Superman and Action Comics, and it was kind of a weird book. I mean, I like part of it. I remember reading it when it came out, and the artwork is took a little bit of getting used to, because Pete Woods maybe isn't the best Superman artist. But the first few issues were fun because we were seeing that Clark Kent was fine with just being Clark Kent, and now he wasn't Superman anymore because he didn't actually have his powers after the Red Sun interaction and Green Kryptonite that he had to deal with when he was taking on Superboy Prime during the final closing pages of Infinite Crisis. So he has no powers for the first part of the storyline, and I actually thought that was really strong. I like seeing Clark Kent actually being a reporter, dealing with, like, kind of being happy. Like, he's sad in some ways that he's not Superman anymore, but at the same time, he's able to live his life. And then slowly, we got to see him kind of dealing with his powers returning. He goes up against the new Kryptonite Man, some kind of a weird assortment of villains, having to deal with being a Superman without having the full access to his powers as they're slowly coming back. Dealing with Lex Luthor, who's dealing with kind of the Sunstone, which is very much a Superman Returns version of Lex Luthor, which, to be honest, I didn't like that very much, especially after, like, at this point, we didn't really know what had gone on during 52, what Lex Luthor had done, but he was already out of prison, already kind of framing everything on his doppelganger. Like, it just felt a little... Oh, wait, am I thinking of 52? Anyways, he's out again here, but I don't know. I did not like how Lex Luthor was written here, and I think the latter part of the storyline really falters from being too much like what we would get in Superman Returns, which I didn't think was nearly as enjoyable. And seeing, like, again, the Sunstone, Fortress of Solitude, I don't know, it just wasn't really for me. It was definitely trying to reestablish Superman, and half the storyline did a great job, and the other half really didn't. After this, you would have Jeff Johns doing the Last Son of Krypton story, I think that's what it's called, with Adam Kubert, which was, you know, a big departure, and I think he was writing that with Dick Donner. Kurt Busiek would do his own thing in the other Superman book, and which was really hit and miss for a lot of people. This is not the strongest Superman story. Again, half of it's interesting, the other half isn't. It's very much of the time. It feels very much like it's trying to cash in on the upcoming Superman Returns film, especially the dialogue. The next storyline in Action Comics would be more so towards kind of solidifying the Superman movie universe as being this kind of new version of Superman, being more and more like that. I don't think 1 year later did a great job. It was a great chance for the writers to really tell a great Superman story. Instead, you get a great Clark Kent story, which then falters and falls apart when you have forgettable villains, a version of Lex Luthor that no one really is that interested in, and Superman kind of dealing with his powers coming back is kind of fun, but it goes on too long. And the next one I wanted to talk about, and I think really the last one, for now at least, is going to be the Batman storyline that we got. And then I'll actually touch briefly on what some of the other books were like at this time. So Batman went through a change. This is, I guess, just before... I'm trying to remember my timeline. I think Grant Morrison came on not long afterwards. Or it's so hard to remember because Grant Morrison came on a long time ago. But this storyline itself, this is Face to Face by James Robinson, who's just a great writer. I guess after this, Detective Comics would get written by Paul Dini, so I feel like this is right around when Grant Morrison was about to take on the book, but I could be completely wrong because, as I said, it has been a long time since I've read everything in this era. But this is from Batman 651 to 654 and Detective Comics 817 to 820. So obviously, after Infinite Crisis, which kind of left the Batman books in kind of an interesting spot, Bloodhaven had been destroyed. Robin and Batman seemed okay, but you know, Batman was going to go on this journey that he's going to rededicate himself for a year, which was never fully captured in 52. We got to see part of it. So he's been gone for a year, so this book kind of says what happens while he's been gone, or what happens when he's back. So we now have Gordon being back as commissioner, which is kind of very lightly touched upon in the 52 maxi series. What's nice about this book, first of all, I want to say, anyone has the trade paperback collection of this, it is atrocious in terms of a reprinting, because when you look at these other books, they all have glossy paper. The other ones I talked about, the Green Arrow, the Green Lantern, and Superman, they all have glossy paper, but Batman, arguably the most popular of the four, especially at the time, has this matte paper that doesn't pick up the details that well in the artwork, so there are certain things you cannot really see in the artwork, which is such a shame, because the artwork is really, really fantastic. It's, trying to see. Again, I don't like how the collections were done at the time in DC books. They didn't always really give that much credit or proper credit as to which issues were done by which artists. Looks like Leonard Kirk and Don Kramer were the pencilers throughout this arc. Basically, it's about the fact that while Batman's gone, Gotham isn't defenseless. Instead, we have Two-Face, or a rehabilitated Harvey Dent is protecting Gotham, and he went through kind of a crash course, although I don't know when this is supposed to have happened, because between the end of Infinite Crisis, we see him leaving for his trip. You don't see him somehow taking the time to train Harvey Dent in bat techniques so that he can kind of protect Gotham while Batman's gone. But regardless, that's what we get. We get Harvey Dent kind of doing the good fight while Batman's gone. When Batman gets back, someone kind of ends up framing Two-Face. Harvey Dent kind of goes crazy, ends up pouring acid on his face and becoming a proper Two-Face again, which is kind of a tragic story because he was a good replacement for Batman while he was gone. At the time the storyline was published, you also have some classic villains being featured. You have Batman and Robin once again being this phenomenal team. You have Robin wearing a new version of his costume, no longer having any green in it after the death of Connor Kent in Infinite Crisis. This storyline's kind of a nice who's who. You have the Ventriloquist, you have Poison Ivy, you have Lieutenant Bard being involved, which we're now seeing him in the current New 52 comics. We have the pre-New 52 version of the character being involved here, and I really liked his backup story. Seeing Batman and Robin doing what they do best, doing team-ups, working with Gordon, working with the police force, in an amicable manner. This felt like a return to form, a return to greatness for Batman and Robin and Commissioner Gordon, although a descent into madness for Harvey Dent. And we also have Batman at the end of the storyline. He's a little bit more touchy-feely here, which was supposed to be him realizing that he had distanced himself too much from his colleagues in the superhero set. So here he actually, at the end of the storyline, offers to adopt Tim Drake as his son. Obviously, Tim Drake had lost his dad in Identity Crisis and had been going through so much, losing his best friend, losing a lot of people close to him. And so then we got this storyline, which kind of puts a nice cap on that. So I love Face to Face. I think it's a great storyline. I don't have a lot of Batman stories from that time period on my shelf, on my trade paperback shelf, I should say. But this one definitely makes the list. It's just a fantastic story. I wish the reproduction was better on the volume so that it would not be so matte looking, instead would have glossier paper, which would capture the dark energy and the dark colors of the art a lot better. But so that's Batman 1 year later. Definitely benefited from a fresh take with James Robinson. It's just funny that he wasn't the new ongoing writer. We then got Paul Dini writing Detective, and I believe Grant Morrison writing Batman, although I feel like maybe he wasn't writing Batman. It's terrible that I can't remember who was writing Batman. I'm actually going to pause the podcast, although you won't know this, and go and check who actually was writing Batman after, because this is really going to bug me. So I'm back, and I've figured it out for myself. So it was indeed Grant Morrison. So it's interesting to look back at this as being, you know, we have this kind of nice reestablishment of the best status quo that people are used to, which is Batman and Robin fighting crime with Commissioner Gordon. And then, like, the next issue, we introduce Damian Wayne, which ends up throwing everything off kilter over the ultimately. So it's just interesting to kind of look at where this storyline fits. In some ways it doesn't, because, I mean, you reestablish a status quo that then isn't used a lot by Grant Morrison, because he goes in a different direction with Damian Wayne being introduced, and then you have Paul Dini writing these kind of more standalone or one or two issue arcs and one or two issue stories, sorry, in Detective Comics. So very different ways to go about it, but neither of them really showing the team-up dynamic that we see in Face-to-Face. So it's just interesting that it's so well-written, so much fun, and yet, in a lot of ways, it wasn't a really great kind of new status quo, because then it would almost instantly be a little bit disregarded by the new writers who would do their own thing. So it's just kind of funny. But it's such a fantastic story that you almost don't care, because it does so well. So looking at just quickly some what happened to the other One Year Later books, Nightwing, oh man, One Year Later was not kind of Nightwing, because right before it, he was getting engaged to Barbara Gordon, and it seemed so great, and then we flash forward a year, and it becomes anything but interesting. I believe Marv Wolfman was writing it, and I think this was the storyline, no, it may have been before Marv Wolfman, but I believe you had Jason Todd briefly as Nightwing, and this murderous Nightwing, and Nightwing on Nightwing action. Just, I don't think anyone really liked it as much as they wanted people to like it. Supergirl got more and more confusing with the Kandor storyline. JSA Classified focused on the fall and rise of Vandal Savage, which was kind of a fun Vandal Savage story. JSA, I believe this is the storyline that ended JSA, or was right near it, and you had Gentleman Ghost, I think it was by Paul Levitz. Kind of an odd feeling book, because it was such a strong book by Geoff Johns prior to Infinite Crisis, and then coming out of it just felt like this tacked on story that kind of ended out the volume. Outsiders got transformed into being a kind of a new proactive team that was kind of on the wrong side of the law almost. Birds of Prey, I don't even recall, to be honest. Manhunter, same thing. Catwoman was no longer Selina Kyle, she'd had a baby in the interim. Now Holly Robinson was the new Catwoman. Definitely a big change in the status quo. Robin, I forget what happened to Robin in his own book. I apologize, I don't remember that well. Aquaman got retitled and became Aquaman Sword of Atlantis. You had a new Aquaman, who at one point was in the Justice League Hero Clicks set that came out in 2007. Arthur Curry was kind of gone, although he was Ocean Master or Dweller of the Deep. It was a kind of a reimagining of the Aquaman mythos in a more of a fantasy realm, but I don't think it ever really took a lot of people that strongly. I don't think a lot of people really enjoyed it that much, and then it ended up being kind of swept under the rug. Hawkman became Hawkgirl, which I've heard never really recovered, and I think it was by Walt Simonson, but it didn't quite jive with people as well as they were probably hoping it would. Checkmate launched as part of One Year Later, which was exciting. And then you also had Crisis Aftermath, Battle for Bloodhaven, Crisis Aftermath, The Spectre. You had Secret Six happening a few months later, issue number one, which was brilliant, and also Shadow Pact started as well. And then a little bit farther after that, where One Year Later wasn't being as branded as much anymore, but technically these are still connected, were the new launch of Wonder Woman, where Donna Troy was now Wonder Woman, and I believe that was written by Jodi Picou, or is it Gail Simone? I really can't remember. You had Justice League of America launched with a new Volume 2, issue number 1, you had Green Lantern Corps started, and you had a new Bart Allen as the Flash series as well. Actually, now think about it, that's the Justice League of America by Brad Meltzer. So that was finally putting the Justice League together, because it had been a while since there had been one prior to you'd had one in the New 50... Sorry. God damn it, there's so many different eras and titles, it's hard to keep them track. There had been a Justice League during 52. It was short-lived. It wasn't that well done as a team or well put together. And then you had this new Justice League of America by Brad Meltzer. And it had the Red Tornado kind of as the main focal point with, I believe, Solomon Grundy as the villain. Anyways, that is my focus on DC One Year Later. the thematic kind of crossover that took place in 2006. As you've heard, some of the stories are really strong. They put the characters in new directions. Some of them, these new directions ended up being kind of short-lived, so it almost makes you wonder why they bothered. On the whole, it probably was successful in terms of, you know, getting people interested, getting kind of a lot of buzz. Instead of doing like a relaunch or a reboot, they just kind of advanced things forward and made people wonder what happened and made people curious about how characters went from plot A, point A to point B. It's interesting that they would do that. They did something like that, and then we're going to have Marvel doing something a little bit similar with its Avengers and New Avengers book, seeing a glimpse of what the Marvel Universe will look like in April, and then having each book actually leading up to getting it to that point. It seems a little bit maybe better plotted by editorial, although maybe I'm giving Marvel way too much credit, which is absolutely possible. Anyways, that is our episode. It's episode 186. This has been our flashback on 1 year later episode. Thank you very much for listening. I believe next week, episode 188, will be our spotlight on Guardians of the Galaxy. Following from there, episode 190 might be our Ninja Turtles episode. It might be a Talking Heroclix episode. It might be the next flashback episode. I'm not really sure yet, but that'll be coming up soon. There should be new episodes of Talking Heroclix probably around 192, maybe. I actually have no idea. In the 190s for sure, as well as the Ninja Turtles spotlight episode. I don't know if there's going to be an episode focusing on the 2 year anniversary of the podcast or not. It may not fit in the schedule, but there will be a 200th episode coming up soon, so please let us know what you'd like to see in the 200th episode, and we'll try and feature it on the show. I'm hoping that we're going to have a lot of guest stars, people showing up who haven't been on the podcast in a while. I'm hoping we'll get maybe Chris Lucas, Paul Scores, Nathan Struck, Amber Struck, maybe Kelly, my wife. I don't really know who's going to be on the episode per se, but I'm hoping we're going to have a bunch of people all as part of it. And it should be, I'm hoping it'll be something fun and exciting and something special because it's pretty crazy to think that, you know, almost 2 years ago I started this podcast just kind of on a lark. I'd listened to other podcasts and I thought, you know, I could do that. I could at least try that. I could see if that'd be something I'd like to do. And I got to say, I really enjoy podcasting. It's a lot of fun. I really appreciate that there's people out there who download these episodes and actually just listen to me blather on, and they keep coming back for more, like gluttons for punishment. So I really appreciate it. It really means a lot to me that people are enjoying the show and download it. You can always email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com. You can like the show on Facebook, although the Facebook page is woefully, woefully out of date. I haven't updated it in a long time, which I really have to get on one of these days. Rate and review us on iTunes. If you let me know what country you're from when you put in your rating and review, I'll make sure to read it on the show. And also, please subscribe to us on iTunes, so that way you can have it automatically updated to your iOS device. So once again, thank you very much for listening to this episode. We will catch you next time. I'm Adam Chapman, signing off. Bye-bye.